Exodus, the book of Exodus, chapter 15, and we read together Exodus chapter 15, verses 1 to 19. If you're using a chapel Bible, that can be found on page 77. Page 77, Exodus chapter 15, from verse 1 through to verse 19. Let's hear together the word of the Lord. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he hath thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he is become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host hath he cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The depth hath covered them, they sank into the bottom as a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is become glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, hath dashed in pieces the enemy, and in the greatness of thine excellency thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Thou sendest forth thy wrath, which consumed them as stubble, and with the blast of thy nostrils the waters were gathered together. The floods stood upright as an heap, and the depth were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, the sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? Thou stretchedest out thy right hand, the earth swallowed them. Thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Cana shall melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm, they shall be as still as a stone. Till thy people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over, which thou hast purchased. Thou shalt bring them in, and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thee to dwell in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. The Lord shall reign for ever and ever. For the horse of Pharaoh went in with his chariots, and with his horsemen into the sea, and the Lord brought again the waters of the sea upon them. But the children of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. Well, we turn for our second scripture reading this morning back to the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 9, and we pick up the reading from verse 5. All right, yep, from the book of Nehemiah chapter 9, starting from verse 5, and if you're using a chapel Bible, that can be found on page 543. Nehemiah chapter 9, starting at verse 5. Then the Levites, Jeshua and Kadmiel, Bani and Hashbaniah, Sherebiah, Hodjah, Shebaniah and Pethaniah said, Stand up and bless the Lord your God for ever and ever, and blessed be thy glorious name which is exalted above all blessing and praise. Thou, even thou art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all things that are therein, and seas and all that is therein, and thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshippeth thee. Thou art the Lord, the God who did choose Abraham, and broughtest him forth out of Ur of the Chaldees, and gavest him the name of Abraham, and foundest his heart faithful before thee, and madest a covenant with him to give the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Jebusites, and the Girgashites, to give it, I say, to his seed, and has performed thy words, for thou art righteous, and did see the affliction of our fathers in Egypt, and heardest their cry by the Red Sea, and showest signs and wonders upon Pharaoh, and on all his servants, and on all the people of his land, for thou knewest that they dealt proudly against them. So didst thou get thee a name, as it is this day. And thou didst divide the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on the dry land. And their persecutors thou threwest into the deeps, as a stone into the mighty waters. Moreover, thou ledest them in the day by a cloudy pillar, and in the night by a pillar of fire, to give them light in the way wherein they should go. Thou camest down also upon Mount Sinai, and spakest with them from heaven, and gavest them right judgments and true laws, good statutes and commandments, and madest known unto them thy holy Sabbath, and commandest them precepts, statutes, and laws by the hand of Moses thy servant, and gavest them bread from heaven for their hunger, and broughtest forth water for them out of the rock for their thirst, and promised them that they should go into possess the land which thou hadst sworn to give them. But they and our fathers dealt proudly, and hardened their necks, and hearkened not to thy commandments, and refused to obey, neither were mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks, and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. But thou art a God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and forsookest them not. Yea, when they had made them a molten calf, and said, This is thy God that brought thee up out of Egypt, and had wrought great provocations, yet thou in thy manifold mercies forsookest them not in the wilderness. The pillar of the cloud departed not from them by day to lead them in the way, neither the pillar of fire by night to show them light and the way wherein they should go. Thou gavest also thy good spirit to instruct them, and withheldest not thy manna from their mouth, and gavest them water for their thirst. Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness, so that they lacked nothing. Their clothes waxed not old, and their feet swelled not. Moreover, thou gavest them kingdoms and nations, and didst divide them into corners. So they possessed the land of Shion, and the land of the king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. Their children also multipliest thou as the stars of heaven, and broughtest them into the land concerning which they had promised to their fathers, that they should go in to possess it. So the children went in and possessed the land, and thou subduest before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gavest them into the hands with their kings, and the people of the land, that they might do to them as they would. And they took strong cities and a fat land, and possessed houses full of all goods, wells digged, vineyards and olive yards, the fruit trees in abundance. So they did eat and were filled and became fat, and delighted themselves in thy great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against thee, and cast thy law behind their backs, and slew thy prophets which testified against them to turn them to thee, and they wrought great provocation. Therefore, thou deliverest them into the hand of their enemies who vexed them, and in the time of their trouble, when they cried unto thee, thou heardest them from heaven, and according to thy manifold mercies, thou gavest them saviours, who saved them out of the hand of their enemies. But after they had rest, they did evil again before thee. Therefore leftest thou them in the hand of their enemies, so that they had the dominion over them. Yet when they returned and cried unto thee, thou heardest them from heaven, and many times didst thou deliver them according to thy mercies, and testified against them, that thou mightest bring them again unto thy law. Yet they dealt proudly, and hearkened not unto thy commandment, but sinned against thy judgments, which if a man do, so shall man do, he shall live in them, and withdrew the shoulder, and hardened their neck, and would not hear. Yet many years didst thou forbear them, and testified against them by thy Spirit in thy prophets, yet would they not give ear. Therefore gavest them that thou them into the hand of the people of the lands. Nevertheless, for thy great mercy's sake, thou didst not utterly consume them, nor forsake them, for thou art a gracious and merciful God. And we'll leave that reading of God's word there, and we'll come to consider part of that in a moment. While I invite you to turn back to that portion we read from Nehemiah chapter 9, and we come again to continue on looking at this great chapter. If the title for the message last time, our first look at this chapter, was The Greatness of God, then the title for this sermon has to be The Hardness of Humanity. The Hardness of Humanity. You recall how we saw in our previous study that in the introductory part of this chapter, the people came together to worship God. They took this seriously. Those who want to worship God must do so seriously and carefully. Not devoid of joy and emotion. That's not what we're saying. To worship God with no emotion, with no joy, with no happiness, is no worship at all. It's a dirge. It's a disgrace. It's something abhorrent to the Lord. That is not pleasing to him. But there also cannot be no wildness, no rejection of order. We see this in creation, that God is a God of order. We see this in his revealed word, the Bible. All the great constructs that we see, the rules of life, the great laying down of rule and order that we see, it's all from God. We see this in God's blueprints for the church. Sometimes we forget that in the Bible we have God's blueprint for how everything is to be run in the local church. We see the great order in that. Time and time again, God even says it himself. He is a God of order and not chaos. We saw something of the nature of God. And we constantly need to be reminded of this. Just how great God is. So that when we are called to worship, we love him for who he is. This is one of the great duties of a preacher or a pastor or anyone who engages in Christian ministry duties. To encourage people to see how great God is. Because if this is something we don't actively try and do, we do lose a sense of how great God is. It is so easy to be caught up in the affairs of life. It's so easy to take our eyes away from the Lord, to look away from him and to forget just how great he is. That God is the creator of this world and that everything obeys God without so much as a moment of hesitation. We read that previously in the chapter. We read it again today. Everything just by its presence testifies that there is a creator. Deep in our hearts, all of us realize that this world is created. There is no other logical conclusion. But as unbelievers, we actively suppress that thought. Because to admit that there is a God, that we are his creations, we have to then answer to him. It's very easy to believe a lie when it's what we want to hear. I'm sure many of us can speak to that or have witnessed it happen, that we kid ourselves with a lie because we don't want to believe the truth. In this case, unbelievers kidding themselves that this world is a product of mindless evolution, of random chances that have all come together and we're just a happy mistake that seemed to be here. But we also saw that this great God chooses imperfect people. The example we have set down is Abraham. The message of the Bible is the greatest love story between a holy God and his will to save a fallen humanity. Amazingly, unbelievingly, astoundingly, this great God who needs nothing and nobody is willing even to have a dialogue, a conversation with a fallen race. I've just been reminded recently, just driving around at the moment, seeing so many people in society, even just normal people, just how unlovable we are. Just how much we grind each other's gears. Just how much we annoy one another. How selfish, how proud, how conceited we can be. And yet God chose to save men and women out of this condition, to set them right, to pour his grace into our love and our souls. We see how he saved his people from Egypt. This same God who is so great, he binds himself, makes it incapable for himself to break his promises. Even though his people have forgotten God, you see that in the midst of Egypt. Even when they have forgotten him, he has not forgotten his promises. Even when they eventually did cry out, and you remember, they didn't cry out at the start. They didn't cry out for over 250 years while they were in slavery. They still didn't cry out to the Lord to help. But all that time, God was preparing and planning. Probably because they had forgotten their love for the Lord, they forgot to cry out to him. And then we see God wondrously saved them. By all things, God is able to use anything for the saving of his people. At the same time, he is able to humble the Egyptians in how they have treated his people. God parts the Red Sea so his people can cross safely through. There is nothing that can hold a child of God. God's power is able to save us from any circumstance, often in the ordinary ways, but when these are insufficient, God directly steps in for us. God never abandons his people or leaves them to fend for themselves. No, he leads us. I was reminded of the chorus of that hymn that goes, "He leadeth me, he leadeth me. By his own hand he leadeth me. His faithful follower would I be, for by his hand he leads me." God is not remote or unthinking about his children. Rather, as a father feels for, provides for, pities his children, every one of them, so God provides for each and every one of us. And then picking up where we left off from last week, or rather last time, "Thou camest down also upon Mount Sinai, and spakest with them from heaven, and gavest them right judgments and true laws, good statutes and commandments, and madest known unto them thy holy Sabbath, and commandest them precepts, statutes, and laws by the hand of Moses thy servant." God is not a God of obscurity. God makes all his dealings with humanity very, very plain because he has nothing to hide. He is a holy God who is concerned with humanity, so he reveals his standards of right and wrong. What is the purpose of the commandments? This is essentially what we're talking about here. Not just the commandments specifically, but all the laws, the recommendations that the Lord gives to how to live our lives. Well, firstly, we have to say the commandments are for conviction of sin and wrongdoing. Paul says as much in the New Testament. "I did not know that this was sin or that was wrong, except that God's word said it was so." They demonstrate that something is very wrong with humanity. This is the standard that God expects of every one of us. And yet, even if you look at them lightly or loosely, rather than plumb the full depths behind the commandments, you can tell that there's something is seriously wrong. If you like, they are all 10 fingers pointing towards us, saying, guilty, guilty, guilty. But that's not the end of the commandments. They're not just there to convict us. They're there to show us something is wrong, yes. And then they point to the Saviour and say, he is the one that saves us. He is the one that can help you. And why some people say, does God do this? Use, if you like, such a strong way to condemn the whole of humanity? Because he's already used subtle methods to try and get us to see. As I said earlier, this whole creation is a proof that there is a God, and yet we ignore that. He gives us instincts in his heart that there is something more than this life. We ignore that. He gives us people who try and help us, other believers who try and point us to God. We ignore those. So what does God have to do? He has to make it utterly plain that there is something wrong. Because this is too important to get wrong. If you want to pass an examination, you try and work out what the examiner is looking for, and you make sure you do that. God here is publishing his commands, his standard, ahead of time, ahead of that final judgment, so that we all know the standard he is expecting. And by the way, he didn't have to do that. Even this is a mercy of God, that he shows the standard he is expecting for each and every one of us. But after conversion, the Ten Commandments, the nature of them changes to a believer. They are no longer to condemn us. Instead, they become a guide for life. They are there for our good. This is why we study them, to see how we measure up to them. The Ten Commandments are there for our rule of life, to show us how to live our lives, pleasing to the Lord, yes, first and foremost, but also for our own good. If you take just one of them, let's take the commandment of no lying. If you could expand that over every person, that none of us would ever lie, would never tell a half truth, would never tell a white lie, but we actually meant everything that we said, how different would this world look? Where there would be no shadiness with words, there wouldn't be any grey areas, but you could utterly trust what someone said. And that's just one commandment. Imagine if you could instate the whole 10 of them. Well, one day they will be after the Lord returns. By keeping them, we cannot earn or deserve our salvation. We have to make that very clear. That's legalism. If you understand the 10 commandments, how deep they are, you understand first and foremost, you cannot keep them. It is impossible. If there was just even a shadow of a way that we could keep them, it would make the sacrifice of Christ less than it actually is. But because we cannot keep them, even in a single part perfectly, God had to send a Saviour to save us. But after conversion, we please God because we put ourselves under the care of the commandments. This is essentially what God is saying here. He reveals his standards of right and wrong to the people at Sinai. He gave them commands, the Ten Commandments, and then the expansions on them, how to apply them to our lives for our good. This is how kind God is. But this is also a demonstration of God's love for us. As parents, we don't let our children go on regardless. We don't allow them to do anything they want. We put limits in place. We put rules in place. Why? Because we want to be unfair or we want to withhold something from them? Of course not. Primarily to keep them safe. Don't play with matches because you don't know what you're doing with them. Don't play with sharp knives. You might hurt yourself. Don't go near someone, something that's dangerous, in case you hurt yourself. These are limitations, and unfortunately, especially when children are very small, they see them as limitations. But why are they there? For the good of the child, to keep them safe. God has done exactly the same with us. And by the way, we should never just see the commandments as a list of do not, do not, do not, but rather you see the two sides of the coin. Do not lie, mean everything that you say. Do not kill, love life. Do not take the Lord's name in vain, but rather hold it as precious. You see how every command has two sides to it. Not just what it's saying, do not do this, but it's also saying, do the opposite. There are two sides to every commandment. Maybe we'll have a look at those at some point. And gavest them bread from heaven for their hunger, and broughtest forth water for them out of the rock for their thirst, and promised them that they should go up in to possess the land which thou had sworn to them. Notice the priorities of God. He deals with our spiritual needs first and foremost. This is our greatest need. A doctor, when he treats a patient, he sees all their symptoms, everything that's wrong with them. Does he treat the smallest thing first? No. He deals with the thing that threatens the life first and foremost. The thing that is most serious. He deals with that. And then afterwards he deals with all the smaller things. God does exactly the same with us. Our greatest need isn't our day-to-day needs. The food that we eat, the water that we drink, the clothes that we wear, the house that we live in, the car that we drive. This isn't our first and foremost priority needs. The Lord provides for all these things. He's kind and gracious in that. But our first and most important need is our spiritual need. That relationship with God, that need to have an eternal future. This is what God first and foremost agrees. This is where we look to the Bible first and foremost for spiritual understanding. It speaks on a huge amount of topics. That much is true. And it's wonderful that it does. But it first and foremost is a spiritual manual for spiritual living. But God is concerned with our daily needs. If only all of us could remember this a little bit more and be reminded of this more. This is another thing which we lose the sense of. Because for all these years, the Lord has provided for each and every one of your needs. And then all of a sudden, and I speak as much to myself as anyone else, a new trial or difficulty comes up and your first temptation is panic. How am I going to deal with this? I've got another thing now that I have to try and deal with. But has the Lord ever failed before? Has he never provided for all that we need? Has he not prepared ahead of time sometimes? So that when the difficulty comes, you can deal with it straight away because the Lord has already planned something to help with that great need. God gives them bread and water. This is interesting in itself. We may disagree with bread and water being essential for life, but what it stands for is this. He gives them what they need. Not perhaps what they want. We see that in the different part of the wanderings, where they wanted meat or they wanted vegetables. They wanted, as it were, luxuries. But these would not cater for their day-to-day life. You cannot live your whole life on sweet food because it will ruin your health. But the Lord gives them what they need to be maintained day in, day out. Spiritually, we don't live for one great show of God's love after another. Sometimes we're tempted, and some believers do think like this. They think, the Lord hasn't done anything remarkable in my life recently, so does he still love me? Well, of course he loves you. But have you forgotten that every other blessing comes from the Lord as well? There are times when the Lord does something fantastically amazing, and they are there to encourage us, to remind us, to give us wonderful memories. But we also think as well of all the times the Lord has provided us day in, day out. Every single moment of every single day, he has given you a breath. He has given you air to breathe. The mind capable of doing everything that it needs. Even many years, perhaps, of good health, or at least adequate health. And yet we forget those sometimes. The Lord supplied them in a remarkable way. We often forget how the Lord provides for our needs. That's why it's good to be a thankful person, to be a person who counts your blessings, who tries to almost, as it were, sit down and come up with a list of everything the Lord has done with us for this past week. Because the Christian who trains themselves to be more thankful, you see more things that the Lord does for us. It kind of reinforces itself. If you don't look back over your life regularly and kind of see how the Lord has helped you, you won't be able to draw any to thought. But the more you sit down and think about it, the more blessings you see. Not that the Lord provides more, but you see more of them. But also remember, this is just the interim care. The Lord providing the bread and the water, this is only for a time. This is a temporary solution, not a permanent fix. This is just to get them through the wilderness and into the promised land where God's blessing would be fully revealed for them. In that is the wisdom of God. Imagine if he had made things so comfortable in the wilderness that the people would never want to enter the promised land. It's the same with us. The Lord gives us lots of nice things in this life. There is so much good things, wholesome things that we can enjoy. But the Lord will never allow us to grow too comfortable and get distracted. This is the problem we have in the Western world. We have so much available to us. We have so many things we can do, so many things we can enjoy. And what do we forget? Even as believers, the good things that we are allowed to enjoy, that there is nothing wrong with, but what do we forget? Our reason for being here in the first place, to worship the Lord, to serve him, to bring him glory, to speak to others about how great he is. And yet so easily we can allow ourselves to get distracted. And then the last thing before we move on a little bit. This promise was over 400 years old. With God, that's nothing. But with humanity, that is a vast span of time. The ones who were given this promise of the promised land, that they would inherit it, that their descendants would be as the stars of the sky or the sand by the seashore, they were dead and gone many, many hundreds of years ago. And if I can say this politely, the people that had replaced them were nothing like the patriarchs. Men of faith who had so little, men and women of faith, I should say, who had so little and yet believed the Lord so strongly, who, if we can put it this way, I say this in a measure carefully, they were actually worthy of the promise that was given to them. Not that they earned it, because you can't with God, but spiritually speaking, their understanding was so greater than the Israelites that we have in the wilderness. And yet God still holds himself to the same standard for his promise. This surely speaks of God's faithfulness, that even the Israelites who were alive then were totally different from their forefathers. The promise still held true for them. And then we see the hardness of humanity. This is, if you like, two strands that run through this chapter, intertwined round each other again and again. But they and our fathers dealt proudly and hardened their necks and hearkened not to thy commandments and refused to obey. Neither were mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. But thou art a God ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, and forsook them not. And that very last part of the verse, I'm not going to say anything on this morning, because I'm actually going to use it for the text this evening. I was reading through this passage and I saw that even half a verse, and I thought, there's a gospel message in itself. So I won't say anything about that one, but I'll speak about the first part of the verse this morning. So as I've said, there's these two great themes running through this chapter. The greatness of God, how wonderful he is, how much he does, and the hardness of humanity by contrast. This is a proof of the Bible's divine nature. Would any other book be so honest? If it was written by bad men, if we can say it like that, or people with scruples in their morals, would they say that the Bible says, if they could write it, if they could pen the words, that there is none that follow God, no, not so much as one? Of course, no one would write that if they were trying to use this book to control the whole of humanity. If it was a good person who wrote the book, would they dare to say such a thing? That God, who is so holy, so great, so perfect in all his ways, would be willing to sacrifice his son to save us when we are so unworthy of his attention? Of course he wouldn't. So even here you have a reminder of this Bible's divine nature, the honesty that you see in the Bible time and time again. But after having seen the wonders in Egypt, the Red Sea crossing, how did the people respond? They murmured. They grumbled. They rebelled. I don't know how many times I have to say this. I will say it time and time again till I am blue in the face. Seeing is not believing. Christ says as much in the New Testament. We are so stubborn. We are so set in our sin. We are so bent away from God naturally that even seeing miracles, wondrous things that only God can do, and seeing them time and time again, you didn't have just one wondrous thing in Egypt. The Nile turning to blood, that would be one thing. Frogs everywhere, that would be one thing. Or the hours of darkness when it should have been light, that would have been one thing. But you had 10 wonders back to back. And then you had the Red Sea crossing afterwards. Could you have any more proofs, almost in the span perhaps of maybe a few months, maybe even a few weeks? All these wonderful things that could not be denied, who had been seen by so many things. And how did these people respond? We don't want Moses to rule over us anymore. We want to go back to Egypt. Is there any, what can you say? The hardness of the human heart. If any of our children did this to us, we would think it was terrible. But when you think of what God had already done for these people, and what did they want to do? They wanted to go back. They went to the extreme of insurrection. They wanted to return to Egypt. Of all the crazy, ridiculous things that they wanted to do, to try and cross the Red Sea, to go back through the wilderness, to go back to a people, oh wait, not so long ago, had sent their armies out to try and slay them all, to destroy them, to utterly annihilate every single trace of them, and to return back to hard slavery as well. But they had this delusion of a time, you see it in Exodus, where they speak of being in Egypt, of resting by the banks, of eating wonderful foods. I mean, they talk about leeks and garlics and onions. I can't think that that's particularly nice, but that's what they were thinking about. But this was completely delusional to what they thought they were actually enjoying. Utter nonsense. How could they have been so hard and unthankful? Except that they never truly believed the Lord in the first place. We can see so many wondrous things and yet still not believe. This is one of the great messages or themes through this chapter. We're fast running out of time and we've got nowhere near where I thought we would get. Pride says, I know best. It can be obnoxious and clear for all to see. I didn't come up with this. I want my own way. This is what these people were saying. They hardened their hearts in pride. They refused to turn their neck. They would not listen to anything Moses and the faithful believers said. They hardened their necks. They were stubborn. They were resolute, and not in a good way. There is a time where we must hold the line, where we must push on with our faith, when this is the right thing to do. But there is also a time when it's very wrong. This was that occasion. They were even willing to depose Moses and elect someone to take them home. What folly and disrespect to God. To effectively say, why did you save us? We were happy. We want to go back. And yet, my friends, we can do exactly the same thing. Maybe not so vocally. Maybe not so clearly. But what does it say when we fall into coldness, into sin, when we return to the way we used to live? Hopefully this warning will restrain us from sinning and grieving the Lord. And then this isn't even the highest insult that they offered. That comes next. Yea, when they had made them a molten calf and said, "This is thy God that brought thee up out of Egypt," and then notice the phrase, "and wrought great provocation." Even while Moses was communing with God, they saw the thunder, the lightning, and they trembled because of it. And then what happened afterwards? I'll read you from Exodus. "And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, 'Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him.'" We do not know what's become of him. We have no idea. So now we want gods of our own. If insurrection, pride, and wanting to return wasn't bad enough, now the people wanted a different god. It wasn't even in some misguided act of piety that they wanted a depiction of God, something they could see because they had been in Egypt so long they had got used to idols being around them on every single hand. This wasn't that. They wanted a different god. Why would you want a different god who had already done so much for you? How can this even cross their minds that they are willing to do this? The ingratitude, the offensiveness. God is not enough. We really want something else. They were also saying, that they didn't really understand God, or they would have trembled to do such an act of insolence. "Yet thou in thy manifold mercies forsook them not in the wilderness. The pillar of the cloud departed not from them by day to lead them in the way, neither the pillar of fire by night to show them light and the way wherein they should go. Thou gavest also thy good spirit to instruct them, and withheld not thy manna from their mouth, and gavest them water for their thirst. Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness, so that they lacked nothing. Their clothes waxed not old, and their feet swelled not." But for all their attitude, God did not forsake them. God doesn't just abandon us when we forget him. Isn't that a wonder? As people, when someone wrongs us, intentionally or not, we might not support them as we once did. But God, his mercy and grace flows even when we forget him. I wonder how many mercies we have been given this week that we did not look for, that we did not ask for, that we did not even think God was supplying to us, and yet the grace flows nevertheless. And we aren't rebels in the same sense as the Israelites here. Even if I can say this, the highest example, it's not really the greatest because it's not a good example, but when I say it, you'll know exactly what I mean, I trust. Even when a believer falls away for a time, this is not someone who makes a profession, goes back to the world, and will never ever be returned, where there isn't a work of grace. I mean a believer who is truly saved, who made a profession, who stood by it, but for a time returns to the world. Someone perhaps like Solomon. We have other examples in the Bible, but he's the most well-known one, unfortunately, and sadly. But even then, the Lord is still supplying grace. Even then, the Lord is still doing amazing things. And the Lord's grace is what will eventually reclaim that person, re-wake that person back up, draw them back to where they should be, and demonstrate that grace once more. God didn't withhold the food and water and hold the people to ransom, saying, "Believe me or I will remove my blessings." That's not how God works. No one can ever say that they were forced into being saved. Rather, God seeks to win us over with his kindness and his mercy. And he didn't just do this for a few years. Originally, it would have been something like 2 years it would have taken the people to cross the wilderness and get to Canaan. And then they rebelled. They had wanted to elect a captain. They ignored the good spies, Joshua and Caleb, and went with the bad report. And then try to go back to Egypt. And they were sentenced to 40 years of wandering because of their disobedience. But for all that time, the people lacked nothing. All sicknesses, discomforts, needs were provided for.
Even their clothes didn't wear out in the sand and the heat. The vast flocks of animals didn't shrink. Sometimes we forget that, I think. Imagine how much food it would have taken to keep all their flocks and herds fed. We're talking about 2 million people. It would have been incredible alone keeping them supplied. But what about all the animals that they carried, that they had with them? And the Bible says their flocks and herds did not shrink, did not wither. If anything, they grew. A wilderness isn't a desert. It's not just barren sand in all directions. But neither is it a lush pasture. And then we'll look at one more very quickly, just before we come to conclusion. Moreover, thou gavest them kingdoms and nations, and did divide them into corners, so that they passed the land of Sihon, and the land of king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, king of Bashan. Even more remarkable, this nation of escaped slaves. I don't think we can quite go as far as say this ragtag group. As we've just said, their clothes didn't wear out. But they weren't a crack force of disciplined, matured people that had had a long history of military action and conquest. These had just come out of 250 years of slavery. Any bravery, any hardness would have been knocked out of them by the Egyptians. We've seen how quickly they fail, their courage falters. But the Lord actually gives them success against kingdoms on their own land, on their own turf. He did steer them away from the Philistines because he knew that would be too much of a challenge. We could apply that. The tendency today of believers is to sometimes worry about what the future will bring. How will the Lord help me if we undergo this trial or that trial? But sometimes the Lord will not bring that trial that we fear because he knows it will be too much for us. So he steers us a different way. That's how you could apply that one. But the Lord always provides what we need. The Lord will always care for us. Here we have this great comparison between the hardness of humanity, and never mistake and think just because we're believers, we're safe from this. We can be as hard as any unbelievers in some senses when we allow that love for the Lord to grow cold. But at the same time, we see just how great God is. I hope that these words have been an encouragement this morning. And now we sing our final hymn.